Howerton? Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Jennifer Swigert here on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Delonte Howerton. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please. There's no question that the police seized Mr. Howerton, thereby invading his liberty interests. The question is whether they had reasonable suspicion to do so based on the information available to them at the time.
Does this court need to address the question of what category or what type of informant we have here?
I don't believe it matters, Your Honor. Under State v. Seiler and under subsequent decisions of this court in the Court of Appeals in Hopkins and in ZUE, essentially a named but otherwise unknown 911 caller or informant is for all intents and purposes the same as an anonymous one. We don't have any real information that would lend any sort of reliability, which is what we're looking for. So when we look at what information these officers actually had, this particular officer, sorry, it was only one who actually detained Mr. Howerton.
It appears from your briefing that the briefing did not consider the fact that Officer or Deputy Hutchinson had knowledge that someone, the reporting person, had actually seen the individual enter the vehicle.
Deputy
Hutchinson. Make a difference?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
First, Deputy Hutchinson did not know that she had seen anyone enter the vehicle, and in fact...
Actually, I think the record's pretty clear that he did.
The dispatcher knew that. I'm sorry if I've misread the record, but my understanding was he testified the dispatcher knew it, but Deputy Hutchinson did not.
The CAD report and the cross-examination make it pretty clear that even defense counsel below understood what was communicated to the officer by the dispatcher, and that is information before he detained him that a reporting person had, and I'll use the word eyewitnessed, what appeared to be a theft of a vehicle and had seen an individual enter the vehicle.
Well, even if we assume that Deputy Hutchinson knew that this was a report from an eyewitness who had actually seen this, we still don't have any indicia of reliability. And I would point this court to the court's decision in State v. Hopkins. Hopkins talks about the concerns that arose in Seiler, where the court realized that, a 911 call could be a prank. It could be a citizen concerned about someone walking while black in their neighborhood.
In Navarette, the court talks about the reliability of someone who actually eyewitnesses the event in question. So the question here is that sufficiently reliable? We're not talking about probable cause, of course.
Correct.
We're talking about reasonable and articulable suspicion.
Correct. And I think the answer to that, to Your Honor's question, is that it was not enough in Navarette. They talked about how there was some increased reliability from the eyewitness contemporaneous account. But the court in Navarette also stated, first of all, that this is a close case. And second of all, they also relied heavily on the fact of the imminent public safety concern. In Navarette, you had a call where a driver reported being driven off the road by someone appearing to be an impaired driver, and this person is still out there threatening other cars on the road. And the court heavily relied on the fact that we've got to take some action here because we've got this imminent public safety threat. And even with that, said this is a close case.
What should the officer have done differently here that would have satisfied Terry?
Any number of things. Talked to the 911 caller, stopped first at her house, knock on her door.
And in the meantime, you have a fleeing potential suspect.
Not fleeing, walking calmly down the street. Apparently only about 50 feet away at the point when the officer...
He didn't know it was 50 feet away.
No, he didn't know he was 50 feet away. And but he also, he knew he was in the immediate vicinity. and he wasn't fleeing. He was doing nothing suspicious.
What if he was running?
If he was running, there we might have a different scenario. Again, this is not a crime where we have a report of some immediate serious threat to public safety. This is not someone waving a gun. It's not a drunk driver running around, possibly crashing into people on the highways.
You're saying property crimes get a different standard.
I'm saying that Terry is, at its heart, a balancing of the individual's liberty interests and the need to investigate crime. And in Navarette, the court explained that, you know, the seriousness of the crime and the threat to public safety plays a role in that balancing. And we're looking at what's reasonable. And when you have a crime that is not an imminent threat to public safety in any way, there's no violence involved, there's no, not even the potential violence of an impaired driver on the highway, when you don't have a threat to public safety, he was walking away calmly, then the balance shifts.
Suppose we're at Pike Place Market and there is a tourist with earphones in, cell phone in hand, doing what most of Seattle is doing, not paying attention and texting. Bystander sees an individual come up, grab the cell phone, and go down First Avenue. Bystander calls 911. They arrive within 3 minutes. They know the identity, a detailed identity of the individual and what direction they're walking. Can the officer who drives down the street then stop that individual who matches that description? This is all within 3 minutes.
Not unless they have some reason to believe the caller is reliable or corroborate
Let's add one fact. The caller, the officer knows that's an individual that actually saw this happen.
We still don't have any indication that the police still don't have any information that would indicate that this is a serious call versus a prank versus an attempt to harass someone. And so it's not unreasonable under that circumstance to have them attempt to verify at least some of the information that might be suspicious before actually going to the step of detaining someone, of seizing someone, of invading someone's liberty.
You're getting very close to probable cause standard, though, aren't you?
No, all we're asking for is some corroboration of some suspicious circumstance. And that's what we don't have here.
So the officer should have stopped his vehicle in the Pike Place Market scenario, interviewed the caller, and perhaps even interviewed the alleged victim in this case, and then pursued.
Maybe not all of those steps, maybe only one of them. Maybe if the person is fleeing, that would, you know, actively running away, then maybe that's enough additional suspicious circumstance for the officer to take action.
Don't we want officers, in terms of just sort of this general notion that officers should be able to investigate potential crime, possibility of a crime that happens within moments, to be able to rely on a citizen informant who reports a call and identifies themselves with their name, phone number, and address, and detain briefly to either dispel that notion or to confirm it. And by then, he's thrown his cell phone in the bushes. So maybe you can answer that on the way back.
Okay, I'll attempt to answer on rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Jennifer Joseph, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney for King County, appearing for the State of Washington. We ask the Court to affirm Mr. Howerton's convictions. The Court's already raised a number of the points that I was planning to raise today, but I think that what we have here is a garden variety, straightforward application of Terry. As the Court has already pointed out, this is a reasonable suspicion standard. It is not probable cause to arrest. And whether reasonable suspicion exists has to be considered based on the totality of the circumstances and whether the suspicion that the officer has come from his own observations or information conveyed through a 911 call. It's still a totality of the circumstances test.
Can the officer
still
have
suspicion.
Confirmed, I guess it was Deputy Hutchinson, confirmed at least by looking for glass or broken window, in this case, the engine's running, lights on.
Could he confirm that a crime had actually occurred?
Or should he have confirmed it? I think that's what counsel is arguing. There's got to be something other than what happened here.
Well, I understand that's what counsel's argument is, but I think that when you have a crime that has just occurred and a citizen has called 911 for service, for help with a crime that she saw occurred in front of her house, the primary objective of the police officer is to figure out what happened and to detain someone who may be involved in that in an effort to confirm or dispel his suspicions. So I think that it does make a difference that this is a citizen informant, not a paid informant. I think it does make a difference that she was not anonymous. It goes to her reliability. And
do we need to first decide what she is? The courts seem to have several buckets, and they're not all uniform about how they refer to a citizen informant. There's some subcategories here.
Correct. Well, I think what the courts have struggled with in some recent unusual fact scenarios is that the informant's reliability is not a threshold determination that has to be made before her information can be considered by the responding officer. He doesn't need to confirm that she is her veracity or her basis of knowledge. Her veracity and basis of knowledge is part of the reasonable suspicion analysis. And so when she bolsters her credibility by giving her name, her address, her phone number, permission for the police to contact her and follow up with her, the police know that she's calling from her home phone, that she just witnessed this event.
Don't we have to focus on what the officer knew before the detention?
Absolutely.
Okay. So do you agree that the record reflects that the officer knew that the reporting person was an eyewitness? I'm just going to shorthand that.
Sure.
Because she'd seen someone enter the vehicle, didn't know whether anything was taken. It's 2 a.m. in the morning, so forth.
My reading of the record is that the deputy wasn't exactly certain what he knew at the time. But that doesn't really make any difference because we know that that information was conveyed to law enforcement through the 911 call,
well,
and it's imputed to him.
He can rely on what the dispatcher tells him. In
Absolutely.
Fact, that's how most people get the officers out there is the 911 call.
Absolutely. That is true. I also wanted to address this suggestion that property crimes don't merit the sort of police response that an emergent a violent situation would. And I think that counsel has sort of reversed the way that this court has seen that in the past. In Saggers and in other cases, this court has noted that when there is a public emergency, we may allow the police to do things that they wouldn't be able to do if there was no emergency. But it is not the case that if it's a property crime, they have to have more than reasonable suspicion in order to stop. Reasonable suspicion is the test.
Does the presumption that this is a citizen informant who we should view as presumptively reliable, does that presumption apply here?
I believe that it does.
Why?
I believe that presumption, from a public policy standpoint, I think we need to maintain that presumption because we cannot have 911 dispatchers or police officers saying, I don't know about that. I don't know for sure how this 911 caller knows that somebody really broke into their basement. I'm just going to ignore that. We have to assume that somebody who is calling 911 for help has a good reason to do it. And in cases, in these unusual cases of Saggers and ZUE and Hopkins, there were some circumstances that did merit a closer look at the factual basis for the 911 call. In Saggers, you had myriad reasons to doubt the caller's veracity, and the officers actually testified that they did suspect that it might be a prank. In ZUE, you had multiple 911 calls about a chaotic situation where the details
we already
conflicted.
Found one opinion that expresses the view that Hopkins may not have been a correctly decided case. And here the Supreme Court has taken review of ZUE. how much do we have to deal with those cases in order to decide the case, given those two circumstances?
I don't believe you have to deal with them at all, because I think that they are sort of outlier cases. What we have here is just the same sort of thing that happens 100 times a day in Seattle. Somebody calls 911 for assistance, and a police officer responds. In this case, was able to corroborate some of the details of her report. He saw somebody that met exactly the description that she gave. He was where she said he would be, and he was traveling in the same direction that she said he would be traveling in. And if you look at what Navarette talks about the corroboration of a 911 call, that's all they had in that case, too. They had this. They found the suspect truck where the caller said it would be, going in the direction that it was, that the caller reported it would be going in, and it met the description and the license plate number. We have at least that much here. On top of which, Navarette considered this caller to be an anonymous caller. We don't have an anonymous caller here. And we also have the fact that Mr. Howerton, upon seeing the police, abruptly changes direction and walks away. Now, I understand that by itself is not reasonable suspicion, but it's part of the totality of the circumstances, and it is certainly a more suspicious reaction than if he had not done that. I have very little else to say, unless you have questions. I think that it's a... All right. Thank you very much.
We are silent.
We ask the court to affirm.
Back to Pike Place Market.
Even for a Terry stop, I understand we're not talking probable cause. We're talking reasonable suspicion. Courts going back to at least State v. Seiler have said there needs to be either indicia of reliability or corroboration before the police can act to detain someone on the basis of third-party information. So in this case, what the state is asking is for this court to find that there's reasonable suspicion based on a third-party report solely because that party is not anonymous and claims to be an eyewitness with no other corroboration and no other extenuating circumstances. And I've been unable in my research to find even one case where a Terry stop has been upheld as being supported by reasonable suspicion on that scant of a framework. There's always either extenuating circumstances, such as an ongoing emergency, or we have some sort of corroboration of something that is not innocuous. At a bare minimum, something that's predictive of conduct rather than simply the pure location and description of the person.
But this person was very close to the address given for the break-in, reacted to the officer. And you had a caller that reported the detail, the break-in in detail.
That's correct. But again, we don't have anything beyond the word of a third party. If the officer had perhaps even seen the blue minivan running in the driveway, you know, corroborated anything beyond the location and position of the person and seen him doing anything other than walking on the street at 2 a.m., then perhaps we'd have the corroboration, but that's not this case. And because the evidence was obtained as the result of this unlawful seizure, we ask the court to reverse.
Thank you.
Thank you.